Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 3rd of August. Our guest this hour has been with us many times before, and his body of work is impressive, and what he writes about are things that we need to know. Today, it's the student loan industry, and in his latest work, he says today just about everyone involved in the student loan industry makes money off students. The banks, private investors, even the federal government. The report is, who got rich off the student debt crisis? 42 million people owe $1.3 trillion in student debt. It's a profit center for Wall Street and the government, and here's how we got into this mess. It outlines what's been happening in this area for many, many years. Our guest is James Steele, and James did his latest investigation into the student debt crisis in collaboration with the Center for Investigative Reporting, featured on the center's radio program Reveal, which you can hear here on WPR on Mondays at 7 p.m. He is an author, and he has worked with longtime collaborator Donald Bartlett and has with him won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, 2 National Magazine Awards, 5 George Polk Awards, including their 35 years of service at the Philadelphia Inquirer, Time, and Vanity Fair. They've authored so many series, and we've spoken with them about most of their series, America, What Went Wrong, which was named one of the 100 best pieces of journalism of the 20th century by NYU's School of Journalism. They have won the Pulitzer for their reporting on the Tax Reform Act of 1986, and they've authored a number of books, Forevermore, Nuclear Waste in America, America Who Really Pays the Taxes, The Great American Tax Dodge, and other books. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I know many of you are dealing with the issue of student debt, and some people are dealing with this issue many, many years after they've gone to school, so we'll be interested in hearing from you. Plus, there are Wisconsin elements to the story that we're talking about this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Jim Steele, so nice to talk to you again. Hi.
Nice to be back with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, it's been a while. Well, it's a very, very thorough article. Sometimes people like to hear in terms of real people, and you talk about the stories of Jesse Surin and Albert Lord. The two never met, but you say their stories tell the history of America's student debt crisis. So let's start with Jesse.
Jesse is a young woman who went to LaSalle University in Philadelphia, first in her whole family to go to school. She'd done very well in high school, and the university extended a number of grants and scholarships, but didn't cover everything, which is the case for, I think, most students nowadays almost everywhere. So she had to take out some loans. She wasn't particularly advised in advance as to what was involved in that process. When she graduated, it was really the height of the recession, and the field she had wanted to get into, which was law enforcement, turned out to be closed to her for various reasons. She went on to find a number of other jobs. But in short, after years and years and years of paying on her student loans, which totaled roughly around $70,000 when she left school, even after paying on these for years and years and years, the total she owes is greater now than when she graduated, which is a very common thing with a lot of people with student loans. At the very best, they just keep current with the interest. If they fall behind a little bit, they get hammered with penalties and various other policies that worked against their interest. And that's what struck us over and over again, is how many of these young people get into this, did not understand the horror of compound interest when you're talking about a loan, and are not advised on this. But beyond that, the system is set up so that these loans make a tremendous amount of money for everybody, and that ends up penalizing the students. One of the reasons we got into this story, and you mentioned Albert Lord, who was the longtime head of Sallie Mae, which most people think of as maybe a quasi-government agency, because at one time it was. But back in the late 90s, it was privatized. It became a fully private company, could buy loan servicing operations, could issue federal loans themselves. Whole series of things were then open to it that had not been the case when it was sort of an arm of the federal government. and Albert Ward headed Sallie Mae during its heyday and made millions and millions of dollars. So much money, in fact, that he was actually even able to build his own private golf course. Hmm. Now, when I say golf course, I don't mean one that anybody can just go up and get a ticket to play at. This is one for Lord and his buddies. I mean, it was that kind of money that he earned while heading Sallie Mae. We use the two of them just as kind of an example. Like, people know the Jesse Searns out there. Almost everybody you talk to, there's somebody. It may be directly in their family. It may be the child or grandchild of a friend. It may be a brother or sister. Almost everybody knows somebody who's been impacted adversely by the whole student loan crisis. But what is not so well known is growing up side by side with this indebted generation, generations now, I should say, is this industry that has profited enormously from these loans.
Mm-hmm.
The servicing of them, the issuing of them, the hounding of the students if for some reason through illness or loss of job they fall behind. So that's one of the things that we focused on in part, not just the victims, but who's really making money off this process.
Well, let's get a little bit of the history here. You remind us of LBJ signing the Higher Education Act of 1965. Any student, you write, who wanted to go to college, he said, would be able to, through federal scholarships and loans. The nation could never rest while the door to knowledge remained closed to any American. So what has happened historically since 1965 to change the whole philosophy?
Well, Johnson Hubert Humphrey referred to Johnson as a nut on education. He'd gone to a little school in Texas, and he felt it was this great door that opened all kinds of opportunities for people if they took advantage of those. So the idea was minorities, people less fortunate, others to find ways through grants, scholarships, loans, a whole range of things, to let them come up. And originally there was a quasi-government agency that came into being some years after Johnson signed that act called Sallie Mae, which actually was created under Richard Nixon. And it was seen as a very far-sighted thing at the time, because here you had this agency that would be the kind of umbrella group that would facilitate this whole process. And for many years it worked reasonably well. I mean, nothing ever works perfectly, but I think most people were generally happy with it. The Department of Education oversaw the program. It wasn't until the 1980s that the Department of Education began to contract out the process of servicing the loans and collecting the loans if somebody fell behind. And that's where some of the problems began. It was then accelerated greatly in the late 90s when Sallie Mae was privatized, and the message sort of went out to everybody. We're going to make student loans, in effect, a private industry, even though the federal government would continue to guarantee the vast majority of these loans. The process of issuing them and all that was turned over essentially to banks, private investors, folks of that sort. And that's when the whole for-profit industry of these colleges also rose, because you had this underpinning, the federal government with guaranteed money. So that was the big change. Rather than essentially a government program, which was the initial idea of it back in the 60s and 70s, with banks also participating then, it evolved totally to essentially a private entity. And the result of that, we basically privatized the student loan industry from the late 90s on. The Obama administration in 2010 took back the issuing of the loans. Those are now done by the federal government. But private companies still service these loans, go after students if they fall behind, and their contracts with the federal government are totally set up on the basis of how much money they collect. Even though there's regulations out there to take into account if somebody's ill, if they've lost their job, the fact of the matter is those contracts are geared towards squeezing as much money out of somebody as they can.
Mm-hmm. And then, simultaneously with all of these changes, you have the need for taking out a loan even greater because of what's going on with the economy, and because so many states in the country, and you highlight Wisconsin here, have cut back the amount of money they're giving to higher education, so the cost of going to a state school is much higher than it used to be.
Absolutely, and we have a calculation in the story that, to our knowledge, nobody else has had. We calculated that if the states overall had continued to contribute money to public higher education, I emphasize here public higher education, at the rate they were doing, let's say, 1980, they would have contributed in excess of $500 billion.
Goodness.
And if you, we calculate also that that's roughly the amount of debt that's out there that's been run up by graduates of public higher education institutions over the years. So it's not, as somebody said once, this is real money we're talking about here. And the fact that states have not kept pace has sort of been generally known. But what we do not think was known was just the magnitude of that withdrawal. It began very slowly back in the 80s, accelerated in the early 90s, and the last 10 to 12 years has just escalated wildly. So the states will tell you, well, we've had other obligations. We've had to do, meet certain mandates in the federal government. There were prisons to build. But the fact of the matter is, this great priority, which states once had, where once they contributed overall nationally 55% of the cost of public higher education, that's down to roughly around 35% today. And the result has been is that states, students who once went to these schools, now have to take out loans to cover their education. And you mentioned the Wisconsin part of this. And
yes.
By the way, every state, almost every state, has been guilty in this area of these cutbacks. But the cutbacks have been particularly severe in Wisconsin in recent years. In fact, the Institute for College Access and Success in Oakland, California, which is kind of the respected data collection agency for this whole thing, put Wisconsin at, I think, saying 70% of folks who graduated there, I believe it was last year, is the most recent year that this data is available. They have the third highest percentage of debt of any state in the country, behind only New Hampshire and Pennsylvania. So those graduates in Wisconsin now, it's just a typical example of how a state that once invested so much in its young people has now pulled back. I mean, one of the census figures on this is just amazing. In 1974, Wisconsin, the data show that people contributed almost $15 per $1,000 of personal income to education. By 2013, that's the last year that's available, that had dropped almost three times. It was only $5 per $1,000.
Hmm.
So they're all, everywhere you look, you see these statistics where there has been this pullback. And as a result of that, even states that have had these really glorious reputations for higher education. I mean, the University of Wisconsin, I've known about as, I've never lived in Wisconsin. I know about the state, but it, you know, that system has had a national reputation for years and years.
Yes, it does.
And that's widely known throughout the country. But this is exactly the kind of thing, the direction that we don't want to be going, to pulling back from that.
And you highlight another story. We'll hear from a lot of people in Wisconsin momentarily, but I wonder how many people are entering the service. They start in college, as Saul Newton, you outline in your story as well. A 20-year-old was a student at UW-Stout, communications major, had $10,000 in student loans and then tuition hikes for 2 years and said, ooh, I just can't do this anymore. I'm going to owe too much money. So he joined the service.
He did, and Saul is one of the most compelling I think personal stories in the whole article. I just coincidentally also happens to be from Wisconsin. He's a very well spoken young man, but so he joined the army, and he wound up in Kandahar province in Afghanistan, which is one of the worst provinces to be in, where the Taliban had been very, very active for a long time. And one day that he will never forget was in August of 2010, when the battalion chaplain and four of the soldiers were killed when a roadside bomb went off. Saul told us that his whole focus when he was there was just trying to do his job and stay alive. But no matter how much fighting was going on, no matter how much the intense stuff around him was, once a month he made his way to a wooden shack that was part of his battalion, where the unit kept a laptop computer that had a satellite internet connection. And it was there that he made his student loan payment. I think it was usually around $100. And he said later, he said it was kind of crazy that a soldier in a war zone had to worry about his student loans. But he knew that if he didn't keep up with it, it would destroy his credit once he got back. And he today is executive director of the Wisconsin Veterans Chamber of Commerce there in Madison. And he's one who's been particularly outraged by the cuts the state has made to higher education, which he says is going to really force more and more young people just like him to perhaps go to war rather than get a college education.
We'll have to talk to him sometime. And the other thing, and this is another part of the story, there are so many parts, but so many of the young people didn't know the ins and outs of all of these loans, and Saul didn't know that he could have had all these payments deferred while he was in the service. Nobody told him.
Right, and this is one of the big problems of the way this system works now, because very often you will call one of these companies that services the loans, and there are many of them, and they very often perhaps don't hire the most knowledgeable people, but I think more significantly, they don't really care to tell somebody that. What they really want people to do is to pay their money, because the more money that they collect, the higher their commissions and potential bonuses are from the federal government. That's just the way the system's set up. I mean, the reason we went this route as a country was not to figure out a profit center or a bunch of private companies feeding off student loans, or in some cases even the federal government taking advantage of it. We did this to make sure there was an education for our young people. And that's what's so out of kilter with the whole program, is that it's become a moneymaker for various interests, rather than initially making sure somebody who needs an education and wants an education gets it.
Let's talk about how much of a moneymaker it is for the federal government. The most outspoken person, and you quote her several times in the article, is Elizabeth Warren, who asked at a Senate hearing, where do these profits go? I'm wondering how high the profits are. She's at a Senate hearing in 2014. We are charging more interest than we need to run the student loan program. There's no mechanism to refund that money to the students. I don't think the student loan program should be designed so that it's making profits for the federal government.
This was one of the big surprises that we had when we delved into this whole issue. We learned early on that there were these companies making money. We learned early on that there were people like Albert Lord who made millions and millions of dollars off this, basically this guaranteed business model. But what we did not realize was that the way these loans are structured is that the federal government itself makes money. The government, because it's the federal government, can borrow money cheaper than anybody else, any bank, so forth. And obviously, they have to charge more than they borrow it for to cover their carrying charges or their carrying costs. But the fact of the matter is, for millions and millions of students up until recent years, the interest rates range from 7, 8, 9, 10%. And the General Accountability Office estimated that hearing you just mentioned, that Senator Elizabeth Warren took the Department of Education official to task at. They estimated that from, I think, 2007 to about 2012 alone, the federal government will earn an estimated $66 billion in profits off these loans. The Congress has since rolled back this for incoming students who take out loans. Even with them, there's still a profit being made. But for anybody prior to 2013, and that's really 40 million plus borrowers out there, all of those people are paying these much, much higher interest rates at a time when interest rates are very low. Mm. And that's one of the most outrageous things about this program. But the reason that they will not change this is because there's an obsession in Washington about deficits and taxes by certain folks, largely in the Republican Party, but not entirely. And if they change this where there was less money coming to the federal government, they would have to make it up somewhere else. They would even have to raise taxes, or they have to cut other programs somewhere down the line. So as a result of that, we have students in part funding part of the operations of the U.S. government overall, while many of them then can't buy a house, can't start businesses, delay starting families, a whole range of things they're paying for that are completely at cross purposes than what this program was designed to do in the beginning.
Mm. And I know, I'm sure you do too, and you found that there were many like this when you were investigating this. I know a lot of people who are in their 40s, late 40s, who are still paying off student loans, and you highlight people who are older than that. You're paying off for years and years and years.
Absolutely, and in fact, what another shocking aspect of this whole thing is that you can be on Social Security, and if the government decides, they can go after and garnish up to 15% of your Social Security payment. And in fact, we interviewed a number of people, one couple in New York who'd actually been reasonably successful in the tech field, sort of moderate income folks, but who lost their jobs after the whole financial collapse, were not able to, they co-signed for their daughter on a student loan, and were not able to make the payment, and they ended up with 15% of their Social Security being garnished by the government. It's not a, it doesn't happen to a lot of people, but it does happen to thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And it just shows you, though, how this thing can follow you all the way through life. And you know, and that's another aspect that puts student loans in a totally different category. In almost every other form of loan, if you run into certain kinds of financial difficulty, health problems, and you go to bankruptcy court, if you have a compelling enough case, you can have that loan set aside or at least reduced. But it is virtually impossible to do that in the case of the student loans. You'll find a case here or there where somebody has persuaded a judge, but the law is very clear on this. You have to prove undue hardship, which is a standard that's almost impossible to prove. And as a result of that, those loans remain hanging around the neck of people all the way through their life, all with it to the time they start collecting their Social Security in some cases.
We're going to go to phone calls in just a moment. Jim Steele is our guest this hour. His latest investigation is on the student loan industry in this country. His piece is Who Got Rich Off the Student Debt Crisis? 42 million people owe $1.3 trillion in student debt. It's a profit center for Wall Street and the government. And here's how we got into this mess. He's won Pulitzer Prizes for his work, great investigative journalism. This piece was done with the Center for Investigative Reporting, featured on Reveal, the radio program, which you can hear on Wisconsin Public Radio on Mondays at 7 o'clock. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, where we like to read your comments, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Steele is with us now. We have many phone calls coming in. Let's start with Jacob. Hi, Jacob. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on the air today.
You're welcome.
I wanted to comment on the student loans in higher education. First, my wife went to Madison Area Technical College here, and I believe she graduated in 2005 and had probably a four-figure student loan debt, which we just finished paying off about a year or so ago, maybe 2 years. And we paid extra on it, as hopefully most people would. But it still took a good 8 years probably to pay off. That was her experience, and I don't have a whole lot to talk about how she was influenced in drawing the student loans. But recently I decided to seek higher education myself, and I happen to be in the military as well, and so I'm very limited in the choice of school that I have. Going to a brick-and-mortar school, it's not tenable if you can't be in the same location over a period of time. And so I'm one of the ones that went with the public school route. And while I have the benefit of the tuition assistance program and have a lot of my costs paid for, that there are some costs that are out of pocket. And I found it particularly interesting how the public schools, the public universities, or for-profit institutions drive their students to student loan. They desire, or my school desires, that you give them authority to draw loans on your behalf. Now, fortunately, I was aware of that and opted out of that program. But while it's not exactly the student loan servicing themselves and their method of collecting from the students, the public institutions are also maybe not direct collusion, but are driving part of the problem themselves in that they are openly encouraging people to seek loans they don't need.
Okay, let's get a response. Jim?
Yes. By the way, Jacob, I couldn't hear part of that. You're cutting out part of time.
So I'm sorry.
So some of my answer doesn't quite fit. Forgive me on that, but I think I got the gist of what you were saying. And, you know, we made the point, actually, in the article that the entire problem with higher education is not just this industry that's grown up. College is too expensive in many situations. And we talked to many college administrators or loan officers who told us, you know, off the record, that in many cases colleges encourage people to take out loans. They think it's very easy because they want to get that enrollment up. So there's no doubt about that. Some of the blame for some of this goes directly to many colleges. Not all. I mean, we also talked to some folks who supervise those programs who are very conscientious and try to familiarize people about that. But a lot of the problem does stem from the fact that there's a lot of financial ignorance in general in the U.S., even among, in some cases, very, very smart people. And this is a part of entry into the society where many young people really could do well to have a little bit more advice than they get, if not from the college, then parents or friends of that sort. But you also mentioned the for-profit schools. And I believe you mentioned those, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, he did.
And one of the things, we did not deal with those in great detail, but we did make the point that these are the classic result of the privatization of the whole student loan industry back in the 90s. While there have been for-profit schools around for years, trade schools that might teach you anything from plumbing to carpentry to many other practices and professions, much of Wall Street really rushed into this field after privatization because it was almost like a green light. They said, here's something where we can make money. The federal government's going to guarantee these loans. And in some very, very significant investigations, Tom Harkin's committee there in Iowa, Tom Harkin of Iowa's committee investigated this issue. And many of these for-profit schools were spending more on promotion, calling up potential students, so that they then qualified for the federal loans, which then flowed into those institutions. In many cases, students who had no business even being in those schools, who were not acquainted with what the kind of money they would have to pay back. A huge amount of the $1.3 trillion is owed by students who went to these for-profit schools. There's no hard data on this, to my knowledge, by the way, which sounds incredible when you think of what a big part of our economy this is. But the estimates are somewhere between 25 and 30% of that $1.3 trillion was run up by those people who went to those for-profit schools, who were very often sort of victimized by an industry that saw only the dollar signs coming from the federal government. Mm.
That's your next report, perhaps, Jim.
Yeah, but there were enough things in that story that just ran that you've mentioned that you could have a half a dozen things of the same size. You're absolutely right, Kathleen.
And then you think of all the people, I don't know many of them, but you look at how much some of these very expensive colleges are, and there are people in this country who can afford to pay, you know, $50,000, $60,000 a year for education for their children, and they really do have a leg up, don't they?
They do, and we made this point, too. The one of the things that is happening with this whole issue is that it's really exacerbating inequality in this country, because the very the most prestigious schools, let's say at the private level, the Ivy League schools, the Stanfords, most of those schools, as a rule, students graduate with very, very little debt. And one reason is because the student body is. Very often they come from families with means. But the second reason is, and I know this is really the case with Princeton, Princeton takes the position that if you're accepted and they look at you and they decide that you need money, they will take care of you. And as a result of that, people who graduate from Princeton at most have just a tiny student loans compared to somebody who graduates from the state university in New Jersey that has many times that in loans. So we're quite concerned about this because it's one of the things that jumped out as we looked at the data, we looked at who was paying. It's going to be a tremendous driver of further inequality in this country because of who's taking out these loans and how it will make it increasingly hard for them to do the things that younger generations did in the past.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jacob, for your call. Tom in Wanakee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Say, I just wanted to, explain or discuss the experience I had. I came out of the service in 1969, went to UWM 6 weeks later. You know, this was August 69. I had the GI Bill, and then because my major, I was going to major in criminal justice, which I did, there was something called the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. Jerris Leonard headed that under mm-hmm. the Nixon administration, and this provided loans to people that were going to major in criminal justice, three areas, law enforcement, the courts, or probation. And out of that, if you served, once you completed your education, or if you dropped out of school, but then went into public law enforcement or the courts or probation, 25% of that loan was paid off. So in 4 years after joining the State Patrol, my loan was paid off. Plus, I had the GI Bill. My point is that the money provided through grants or loans like this, and even if it was a small interest loan, provides so much in return. My earning power over the last, well, that was 72, 73, is a lot more, I think, than I would have had. And plus what one is able to contribute to society, it can't be measured. And I think, you know, for whether it be in the field of education, nursing, law enforcement, I pick a field, provide the money up front, and you're going to get it back many times over in many ways, not just tax revenue, but many ways over for society.
Jim.
Tom, I couldn't say that any better than you've just said it. I mean, that's exactly right. And that's exactly what we used to do in this country. I mean, that's what was largely at the heart of so much of the state support anyway, the public support of higher education. The whole idea is we really were investing for the future. Now, one of the people I interviewed for the story is an economist who studied this whole issue for many years. And he talked about exactly that issue. And he said, you know, we ought to be investing in the future, not taking from the future. And he said, where I used to live, which was in a rural area, we call that eating our seed corn. Hmm. And that's really, I mean, you've expressed this perfectly. We're not investing for the future, not only in this whole series of areas beyond just education. We can talk about infrastructure and many things. But what could be more important than our young people? And what could be more important to democracy and what this country is all about, to give everybody a chance? You look at the people who have made their mark in this country over time, yes, some came from wealthy families, but a tremendous number of them came from families with very little means who got some assistance. And that was that gave them the leg up to do great things and thereby further contribute to the society.
We also need to, there's so many parts of this story, talk about money in influencing legislators. You talk about Sallie Mae's contributions to Republican and Democratic legislators and John Boehner going golfing with Albert Lord on his private jet several times, although he would claim that it had no influence over how this industry is regulated or not. But you can't help but look at the issue of paying legislators, right?
Absolutely. I mean, Sallie Mae not only contributed money to Boehner and gave him rides on their plane, but also Sallie Mae and the big banks have been very instrumental in contributing to those committees that tried to keep the student loan industry intact. And the most dramatic thing they did was, and I mentioned this earlier, but I can explain in a little more detail now, the most dramatic thing they did was in 2005 when they got something through in the bankruptcy bill that changed, made it much harder in general for Americans to declare bankruptcy. But it especially made it much more difficult for anyone who had a student loan. And that was something they lobbied for and succeeded in getting in that bill. And the ink was no sooner dry on that than many people who were concerned about what that meant to somebody who had a legitimate case. I mean, we're a country that long ago got rid of debtors' prisons. I mean, that was one of the things that separated us ultimately from the mother country. The idea everybody needed a fresh start, figure out a way to give that to them if you felt they deserved it. But that's really been taken away now completely in the whole student loan field. And once that was finalized back in 2005 and people saw what had happened, people were concerned about this, bills have been introduced in almost every Congress since then to overturn that provision. To eliminate the so-called undue hardship provision, so it would make it easier for somebody to declare bankruptcy. Wouldn't give them a pass by any means, but it would just put them on the same level
sure.
as other people seeking to do, to have their debt set aside or at least altered and changed somewhat. But every time that's come in, it's been turned back by the Sallie Mae lobby, by private banks and investment companies that have a piece of this whole thing, because that's not in their best interest.
We're talking this hour about who got rich off the student debt crisis, 42 million people owing $1.3 trillion in student debt, a profit center for Wall Street and the government, and here's how we got into this mess. Jim Steele, investigative reporter, is with us. He's won two Pulitzer Prizes, National Magazine Awards, Polk Awards. He and Donald Bartlett have been with us many times on their previous investigations. This one Jim did with the Center for Investigative Reporting, and it was featured in, maybe you heard it, Reveal, which you can hear that show on WPR, 7 o'clock on Mondays. More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to an email, Jim, from Michelle. I find this whole situation frightening. I used to work for the Great Lakes Higher Education Corporation in the 1980s, and the addition of loans where the interest begins to accumulate when the student is still in school is another blow to a student once they graduate. What can be done about this problem? Has anybody posed a solution? I understand Congress makes the laws regarding student loans other than Elizabeth Warren. Is anybody trying to do anything about this?
Well, it's a very good question, and a handful of senators I know, and Elizabeth Warren has probably been at the head of them, but a number of others have actually proposed legislation each year, not each year, but let's say since 2014, to try to at least reduce the interest rate on loans that people have taken out in the past. This would cover probably around 40 million individuals who have these loans, and it would require some kind of an offset, which would be a tax increase or a change in appropriations for some other mm-hmm. agency, mm-hmm. and that's gone nowhere in Capitol Hill because of the way that issue lines up there. I mean, the Congress has been obsessed with this whole issue of the deficit, which means they don't want to spend any money, so if you did something like this, it technically would mean less money coming into the government. So they've opposed it. So there are people who are concerned about it, not just her. There are many people who have looked at this issue. A number of think tanks have seen this as well. And it seems like an unsustainable model the further we keep going on this. But until somebody really grabs hold of it, major relief for those people is not going to come. Obama, to his credit, has changed a number of these provisions, which have made things less onerous than they were. And one of the most significant things that was done under his watch was the taking back the issuing of the federally guaranteed loans from private companies like Sallie Mae, and the federal government itself now directly issues those loans, cuts out the middleman, saves everybody a lot of money. And that's been, I think, a very good step, but that's only been enforced now for a very few years, and it doesn't cover those millions of others who had loans before that. So there's so much gridlock in Washington in general, unless until you got some kind of a Congress that could agree on some basic issues, probably very little can happen there. But Michelle's absolutely right. Something should be done there, because the way that interest can accumulate, the way penalties can add up. I mean, we talked to person after person after person who has more debt now than when they left college. And that's a crazy situation. And these are people who, in many cases, have remained current with their loans in terms of the interest. But because of other factors, they haven't been able to in any way eliminate that obligation.
Let's go to Eugene in Viola next. Hi, Eugene.
Well, good afternoon, Kathleen. I come in the same category as your former caller. I'm in my late 70s. I got in the student loan program in the late 60s and early 1970s. And at that time when you borrowed, you've already said some of this, but at that time when you borrowed money, you only had to pay 3% interest. And if you taught in a low-income district, they discounted 15% of your loan a year. Now, when I started, got ready to start school, I was just plain dirt poor. I wouldn't have gotten an education if it hadn't been for those student loans. So as a result of that 15%, I didn't have to pay any of my student loans back, and I contributed to society.
Jim.
Well, Eugene, I think there are many, many people in that same situation. I mean, I could consider myself in a way that way. I grew up in Kansas City and worked my way through college. And I started out at what was called the University of Kansas City, which is a private school. And I was able to afford the tuition for one or two semesters. And then I don't know what I would have done had not the state of Missouri taken over that school and made it part of the state system, where immediately the tuition dropped by probably 75%.
Ooh.
I can't remember the exact numbers at this point, but all I can remember, the tuition was manageable for me. It was working, so I could pay that tuition. And so, I personally know exactly what you're talking about. But I would not have been able to go to that school had the state not assumed the responsibility for it.
I remember doing work-study programs, which were very prevalent when I was in school. It was a way to make, you know, fairly decent money, and there were a lot of jobs. You didn't have a problem getting one.
Right, and of course, that's another issue out there today. It's just the jobs that pay well are just very often not there, and which is something that I've written about many times already. I mean, it's part of that whole erosion of the economic base of a lot of the American middle class. And that, along with colleges charging more, has been a big factor in why so many students have had to take out the loans.
And so it's
not one thing, but everything is worked to the advantage of the industry, because the more loans that are taken out, it means more servicing fees. It means also, just by the natural order of things, more people will default. And when that happens, then there's more money to be collected by squeezing money out of them one way or another. So the industry thrives because each year the student loan universe just gets bigger. And I think that's one of the things that struck us the most about it. It's roughly a $140 billion a year industry. I mean, the agency within the Department of Education that administers this program is basically one of the largest financial institutions in the world.
Really?
I mean, they're responsible for $1.2 to $3 trillion
in
loans out there. And as the late Everett Dirksen used to say, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Right.
And I mean, it's one of the, in effect, one of the largest banks in the world. And I think that's the other thing that kind of surprised me about the whole thing. It's like, I know about the Department of Education. We all know about that. But the size of this entity and the fact that it's not overseeing these companies that it's put in charge of this process is just really a tremendous shirking of their own obligation, not just to students, but to taxpayers and the country as a whole.
Yeah, and people wonder why the electorate is mad this year.
Right.
That's one part of it, right?
Exactly.
Thanks, Eugene, for your call. Stephanie in Arcadia, hi.
Hi. The problem isn't just for the students getting the loans, the parents. My son, we have four children, ages 10 to 18, and our son can only get a $5,000 student loan. He's our first child going to college. We're expected to come up with the rest of the $15,000, almost $15,000 for him to go to school. And that, where are we supposed to come up with that money as parents?
Well, I'll tell you what's happening with so many parents, and this is not good news. There's a whole private market growing up of what I call private student loans. These are loans not guaranteed by the federal government, but very often fill that kind of gap. And their terms are usually more onerous than the federal loans. You have less ability to, like, renegotiate them if something should happen. And it's an increasingly growing problem as college does become more expensive. And as a lot of the middle class cannot come up with this money, partly because school's gotten more expensive. So it's a real problem, and I really sympathize with it. We talked to so many people in that situation, and that's why this problem isn't going away. In addition to the federal government, which insures most of the loans, you're increasingly now going to have more of this private industry picking up the slack of where the government's not there.
And can you max out with a federal government loan, Jim?
You can. The number is, nobody should hold me to this number right now, but I think it's roughly around, for undergraduates, around 30,000 now.
Okay.
In terms of, but that doesn't, that's just what's borrowed. I mean, that can add up with interest and penalties to two and three times that.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people end up with. An awful lot of the students we talked to had a combination of both federal and private loans. But even in some cases, you couldn't tell what they had, because what a lot of the investors have done with both the federal and in the past and the private loans is that they bundled these loans up like they did in the housing crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And sold these to investors like they were bonds, saying there's a fairly guaranteed return, and if somebody doesn't come through, it's only going to be a portion of what's owed, and they can't go to bankruptcy court, so you can go after it. You can hound them forever. So all over the country, there are these investment vehicles that people have bought to basically take advantage of what's available. And it's just part of the hidden nature of this whole industry out there that goes well beyond just the names you recognize.
Let's take, we have less than a minute, but let's at least get a comment. Jake in Oshkosh.
Hi, Kathleen. Great guest. I've listened and read much of his material in the past. My compliments to you and your guest. I want to comment quickly on the bankruptcy part of the student debt.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it cannot be discharged. This is the hyper-political environment we have today. It doesn't matter whether it's the current occupant of the White House, the future occupant of the White House, you are going to get the same as in the future as you have today in this regard. In Congress, I think the American people have pretty much given up Congress.
Well, Jake, I think you're probably right. Jim, do you think so in 10 seconds?
I think this is true. I mean, I think Jake's right. There is so much frustration. And it's not all coming from the same direction, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's just a general feeling. feeling that the simplest kinds of things cannot get done.
Yeah. Jim, thank you so much for the report. Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you, Kathleen. Always an honor to be on your program.
Yeah, an honor to have you on. James Steele, investigative journalist. His piece is on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and it's important. One, as all his work is. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show and for on-air production.